Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show!
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another infectious disease episode. Really excited to have Uttara join us here today. Uttara, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm really thrilled to be here today. I'm a second year ID fellow at Stanford and have an interest in antimicrobial stewardship and global health and all things clinical reasoning. So I'm super excited to be presenting this case today.
We're excited for your case, Uttara. And Uttara is coming to Atlanta in a few weeks. So excited to see you and Mark and hang out. And I know ID Week is happening soon. Varun, how are you?
I'm great. It's great to see you, Yusuf, and great to meet you, Uttara. I'm super excited about this case. You know me, I love clinical reasoning. That's sort of why I love ID, and I'm excited to hear what we've got cooking today.
Yeah, let's do it.
Awesome. So I'll go ahead and get us started. So today we have a 75-year-old woman who presents with 3 months of worsening left eye pain and redness. So I'll go ahead and tell you guys a little bit more about this woman. So she has a past medical history of type 2 diabetes, CKD, hypertension, and seropositive rheumatoid arthritis. She tells us she was in Mexico for the past 3 months taking care of a sick family member who had cancer. Her symptoms all started while she was in Mexico. She reports around 3 months of worsening left eye irritation, redness, blurred vision, and pain. She was prescribed ibuprofen by a local PCP, but has not been taking this regularly and is not sure if this helps. She has never had symptoms like this before, and her right eye is unaffected. She also reports some slight worsening dyspnea over the past few months, around the same time that her eye symptoms started. She says that she noticed that she's unable to walk for a block. She's usually able to walk for 2 blocks before getting tired. She also has a non-productive cough associated with her dyspnea. She does not report any weight loss, fevers, chills, or night sweats. So I'll stop there.
Awesome. So it sounds like we hear about a 75-year-old female with rheumatoid arthritis coming in for a few months now of red eye and maybe some cough, shortness of breath. I think I can tackle the red eye first. Is usually when I think of red eye, I think of, is this an outside-in job or is this an inside-out? And there are many, many benign conditions that cause red eye. So I think of the things like conjunctivitis, for example, allergies are so common, blepharitis. But as I think of red eye, I start screening for red flags that make me want to think of a process that is inside out. So here we, first of all, hear that this is subacute to chronic over 3 months. We hear about blurry vision and pain. And these are all red flags to make me think of this is a process going from the inside out. So considering things like keratitis, scleritis, uveitis, etc. So that makes it broad. And we start hearing about a systemic fingerprint here with some cough and shortness of breath. And could this be a process affecting both? And then in terms of the rheumatoid arthritis, I'm starting to wonder, is this patient any medications for rheumatoid arthritis? Is she immunocompromised in any way? Varun, any thoughts at this juncture?
Yeah, that's a great summary, Yusuf. I had similar thoughts as I was hearing this first aliquot. This is a 75-year-old lady who may be immunocompromised depending on what medicines, if any, she's on for rheumatoid arthritis. And that automatically opens up the infectious disease differential a little bit more broadly, who is presenting with a subacute process, progressive process, involving one eye and seemingly the pulmonary system as well. And We'll wait to see what the physical exam shows, but I also share your concern about the possibility of uveitis. And when I think about infections that can cause simultaneous pulmonary disease and ocular disease, that narrows down my thoughts. So I think about fungal infections. I think about atypical bacterial infections, including mycobacteria, specifically like tuberculosis. I think about nocardia. There are some parasitic infections that can affect the eye, notably toxoplasma, though typically I imagine its pulmonary manifestations to be more acute, like a pneumonitis. And so those are some initial things going through my head. I'm also curious about this residence in Mexico and if that makes her at risk for some endemic infections, including not only tuberculosis, but coccidioides as well.
Tara, can't wait to hear more.
Awesome. That was an amazing discussion. So let me tell you a little bit more about her. So her current medications include lisinopril, 20 milligrams daily, metformin, 500 milligrams daily, and pagliflozin, 10 milligrams daily. She used to take methotrexate for rheumatoid arthritis years ago. Her last dose was 2 years prior to this admission, but has not followed with rheumatology in many years and stopped taking this medication on her own. In terms of her social history, she's originally from Mexico, but currently lives in the Central Valley area of California. She immigrated over 30 years ago. She's Spanish-speaking. She lives with her husband, who is healthy, and she has no known sick contacts other than her family member in Mexico with breast cancer, who she was taking care of. She does not work. She used to work as a house cleaner, but retired over 10 years ago. She does not smoke cigarettes, drink alcohol, or use any illicit drugs. She has never been incarcerated or unhoused. Her only travel has been back and forth to Mexico, where she goes to visit family every year.
Thank you, Tara. And I think one big tension is playing in my mind right now is this syndrome infectious or autoimmune? I am biased that Tara is presenting the case. I'm thinking about infections, but rheumatoid arthritis can progress to many ocular manifestations. So RA is a polyarticular symmetric autoimmune disease, typically affects small and large joints. But if left untreated for years, it can have some complications. So it can cause rheumatoid nodules and rheumatoid vasculitis. This vasculitis can actually affect the skin, the nerves. A lot of times patients can present with a mononeuritis multiplex, for example. But interestingly, it can also present as with ocular manifestations. So it can cause episcleritis, scleritis, and even keratitis as well. The largest morbidity with rheumatoid arthritis is cardiac. And although here with the cough, we're thinking about the lungs more than the heart. So this tension is playing in my mind. Is this related to untreated RA, or is this an infection that the patient is exposed to? Any thoughts, Varun?
Yeah, I think it's important to make sure that we don't forget about the non-infectious differential diagnosis, especially because it can be easy to anchor to elements of the social history that activate specific infections because of buzzword associations. So residents in certain parts of Mexico or the Central Valley certainly makes you think about coccidioidomycosis. But before anchoring on those salient features, I think remembering that her underlying disease could also affect both the pulmonary system and the eye. I think we have a little bit more compelling information now that we do need to be worried about endemic disease, given that she's had long-term residence in a coccidioendemic area, as well as potentially tuberculosis, given that she's been in Mexico many times. I don't have any other signal for other opportunistic infections, since she has not been seemingly on an immunosuppressive agent in a long time. Certainly having untreated rheumatoid arthritis makes you wonder if she has a completely normally functioning immune system, but it doesn't compel me to think about some of the more unique opportunistic infections that usually I associate with, for example, prolonged neutropenia, like invasive mold infections, and so on. So my differential hasn't really changed all that much from the first aliquot. I just have some more compelling supportive social history.
Yeah, and I think the word like Central Valley immediately triggered me to click Coxy on a multiple choice question, and this has been hammering home like step one, step two, step three. So back to you, Otara. Can't wait to hear more.
That's a really great discussion. I think that tension you mentioned, Yusuf, about, you know, is this an infection or not, given her history of RA, is exactly what we were feeling at the time. And definitely Coxy is, you know, really always on the front of our minds living in the Central Valley. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. So let me tell you a little bit about her vitals and her physical exam. So in the ED, her vitals were as follows. Her temperature was 98.7 degrees Fahrenheit. Her blood pressure was 152 over 60. Her heart rate was 74. Her respiratory rate was 16 on room air. Her initial physical exam was as follows. She was sitting in bed. She appeared mildly uncomfortable, but in no acute distress. Her left eye had some conjunctival erythema, no drainage or purulence, no obvious lesions, no evidence of any foreign body, and her extraocular muscles were intact. On her abdominal exam, her abdomen was soft and non-tender. On her lung exam, her lungs were clear to auscultation bilaterally. Her cardiac exam was normal. No murmurs were heard. On musculoskeletal exam, there was no synovitis noted. She did have some findings of chronic rheumatoid arthritis, including bilateral ulnar deviation. She was alert and oriented times four, and she had no obvious cranial nerve defects. We did get some basic initial labs. Her white blood cell count was 4.4 with a normal differential. Her hemoglobin was 12.3 with an MCV of 83. Her platelets were 167, and we did not have any baseline labs for comparison. Her sodium was 137, K of 4.6, and creatinine of 0.8. Her AST was 43, ALT of 23, an ALKFOS of 161, a T-bili of 1.1, and an albumin of 3.3. Her A1C was 8.8%. We did get inflammatory markers. Her ESR was 36 with a CRP of 6.2. The ED consulted ophthalmology, and they did a more in-depth eye exam. Her right eye was normal. In her left eye, they did notice some ulcerative scleral whitening and central scleral thickening with an overlying epithelial defect. A diagnosis of left eye necrotizing nodular scleritis is made. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Tara. So to recap, sounds like the patient is afebrile. Labs largely unremarkable, although we do hear that the A1C is 8.8%. So potentially a component of uncontrolled diabetes here, and was diagnosed with scleritis. Before I jump into the differential diagnosis of scleritis or what are the causes of scleritis, I'm just going to put a reminder out there that you can also Google the anatomy of an eye right now as I'm going through it. But the areas of the eye that are exposed to the world include the conjunctiva. The conjunctiva is like the transparent part that covers the sclera, which is the white region of the eye. And then the cornea is also exposed to the world. So as you can imagine, the causes of conjunctivitis or keratitis are largely organisms that come from the environment and go in. On the other hand, if you think of the sclera as hiding underneath the conjunctiva, it's the white area underneath, the most common causes of scleritis are actually autoimmune or infections that come from within as well. So even though it can rarely be caused by HSV or VZV, they're typically acute. And here we hear that the subacute picture makes me think of all the processes that are inside out. So this includes untreated rheumatoid arthritis, GPA or ANCA-associated vasculitis, polyarteritis nodosa, lupus, and very rarely spondyloarthropathies. And then the other big category is like post-surgical or post-trauma, although these are less likely to come to medicine and more likely to go to the ophthalmology team. So the big infections I think of that cause scleritis, I think of, like Varun mentioned, tuberculosis, and like Varun mentioned, TB. And when I think of TB, I want to look down and look at the lungs. The other one is syphilis. So I want to do a thorough skin exam to look for any syphilitic dermatologic complications. And HIV is a big category. And then the degree of immunocompromise here, we hear about an HbA1c of 8.8%, which makes the patient at least moderately immunocompromised in the neutrophil domain. But Varun, love to hear from you.
Yeah, a lot of information packed in this aliquot. The first thing I'll say is I usually think of the eye exam as very analogous to the neurologic exam. And like Yusuf mentioned, we are really reliant on our ophthalmology colleagues to help us localize the lesion because the differential diagnosis of the inflammation of different compartments of the eye is very much dictated by their exam and as much of the exam as we as internists feel comfortable performing. And so as an example, anterior uveitis has a very different differential diagnosis than posterior uveitis, than retinitis, and then, of course, scleritis, as we're seeing here. And as Yusuf indicated, when I hear about scleritis, I typically think about autoimmune diseases, not so much infectious diseases, because the sclera is the superficial layer of the globe. And infections that affect that part of the eye are often either contiguous spread infections from outside the eye. So thinking about bacterial scleritis from contaminated contact lenses, or viral scleritis, as Yusuf mentioned, from a reactivation herpes virus like herpes simplex or varicella zoster affecting the superficial epithelium. In some cases, amoebic disease, again, from contaminated contact lenses. And in terms of diseases that can affect the other parts of the eye or any part of the eye, TB and syphilis are always on that list because they can affect the posterior uvea, the anterior eye, the sclera, any compartment of the eye can be affected by those organisms. If we are invoking simultaneous eye disease and lung disease, I would, of course, prioritize TB over syphilis in that differential diagnosis. Again, I think primarily about autoimmune disease when I think about scleritis. I will note that there are some granulomatous infections that can often have rheumatologic manifestations or manifestations that can mimic rheumatologic diseases, and TB is among those. And the other is coccidioidomycosis. So I'd want to carefully examine this patient for signs, for example, of erythema nodosum or erythema indurotum, if you're thinking about TB, as potentially a simultaneous manifestation that is more subtle, but would be indicative of those infections along with the scleritis.
And Varun, what makes the eye like special? Is it just like any other mucocutaneous space in your mind, or is it like the site of drainage for specific infections, or what makes the eye special?
So the eye is, is a privileged site, so similar to the brain or the testis, and because of that, organisms have to have unique tropism to get into the eye, or they have to have some other vehicle to make it into the eye. So, for example, thinking about septic emboli from endocarditis. Otherwise, ordinarily, most organisms cannot make it into the eye or affect the eye. So that's why the differential diagnosis is so much narrower, and why localizing the lesion based on your exam is actually a really powerful diagnostic tool.
That was awesome. And I love that analogy to the neurologic exam about kind of localizing the lesion to help guide your differential. So I'll go ahead and give you some more information. So our ophthalmology colleagues get an HSV and VZV PCR from the left cornea, which was negative. They also get cultures with an initial negative Gram stain, bacterial, fungal, and AFB cultures, which are all pending from the left cornea. Rheumatology is consulted given this concern for possible uncontrolled RA, and they recommended several labs, an ANA, which is negative, an ANCA, which is negative, a C3 and C4 level, which are both normal, an RF level, which is elevated, and an anti-CCP, which is positive. HIV and RPR serologies are negative. A quant gold is negative. An initial chest X-ray shows numerous bilateral less than 1 centimeter nodules diffusely, and a CT chest is obtained, which shows a miliary pattern of diffuse pulmonary nodules. So at this point, ID is consulted. So while seeing the patient, we elicit some additional history that the patient has also been having some mild headaches for the past several months. At this point, we recommend a TB rule out, and sputum AFB smears are obtained 3 times, as well as MTB PCRs, which are all negative, cultures pending. We also recommend some brain imaging. An MRI brain shows numerous subcentimeter enhancing lesions throughout the brain. Several are solid, but some are rim enhancing. And then it also shows some enhancing lesions within the cervical spinal cord at C3. The next aliquot will reveal the final diagnosis.
Oof, Tara, it's a heavy aliquot with a lot of information. So it sounds like we hear that the HSV and VZV are ruled out, and the CT now shows diffuse pulmonary nodules, and we see on the MRI brain numerous brain-enhancing lesions as well. I think we have like officially entered the realm of like lung and brain cavitary lesions, and infectious disease doctors usually have like a specific mental model of that syndrome. I like to think of it mechanistically. So I wonder sometimes about, is this an infection in the heart? And is the heart pumping towards the lungs and the brain? So is this an endocarditis? And the fact that this is chronic is making me think that this is not, for example, a bacterial like staph or strep endocarditis, which is typically very hyperacute or acute. And this is putting that less on my differential. I also think of like intravascular infections like Klebsiella or Fusarium. If this was the right exposure the right host, that could be on the differential. And then just by the sheer prevalence, I think of like Varun mentioned TB and dimorphic fungi. Although here we hear that the AFB smears and the TB PCRs are negative. So that makes pulmonary TB much less likely or essentially ruled out. We also hear about the negative quant gold, which makes that tells us that this patient is probably less exposed to tuberculosis. Varun, would love to pick your brain. What are you thinking at this standpoint?
Yeah, that was great, Youssef. And I will also invoke the so-called lung-brain syndrome as we approach this case. And what's interesting about the lung-brain syndrome, when you tell an ID doctor about the lung-brain syndrome, there is this implicit assumption about the pathogenesis of the syndrome, in that we usually think about organisms that were acquired via the respiratory route and then disseminated with some propensity to the nervous system. Because there's a lot of infections that can simultaneously affect the lungs and the brain, but we don't usually invoke those when we talk about the lung-brain syndrome. So some of the entities that you described, like endocarditis or invasive pneumococcal disease, often can affect the lungs and the brain at the same time, but aren't necessarily in that bucket of organisms that get sort of intuitively activated when I think about the lung-brain syndrome. Some things about this aliquot that are interesting to me. So the patient has had sort of a workup for the more superficial infections that we talked about potentially causing scleritis, which thus far are negative, which again is consistent with what we were thinking, which is a more subacute indolent infection. The patient has a miliary pattern of nodules on their CT scan and multifocal and a large number of ring-enhancing lesions in the brain, which suggests a hematogenous process. And so in terms of disseminated tuberculosis, I think that's an important consideration. And unfortunately, the tests that we have so far are not perfect for that entity. Miliary tuberculosis is classically Pauci bacilli, because the organism is in the bloodstream and not in the airway. And so it's not uncommon for patients to actually be smear negative in miliary tuberculosis. And the MTB PCR also has reduced sensitivity when you're smear negative. And then the quant gold is not a helpful test if you think the patient has active TB, because that is exactly the scenario in which their cellular response is not controlling the pathogen. So I think TB is still an important consideration in this case. And I think specific things that make me wonder about that are the involvement of the parenchyma of the brain, in addition to the miliary pattern, which is characteristic of TB. Endemic fungal infections can also cause a miliary pattern, notably histoplasmosis, though it doesn't sound like we've heard at least that this patient has been in a histoplasmosis endemic region. But certainly blasto and cocci can also cause that pattern. When I think about blasto affecting the nervous system, I also think about mass lesions in the brain, though the number of lesions here would be unusual. And then when I think about cocci affecting the brain, I typically invoke meningeal disease rather than mass lesions in the brain and the spine. But again, it can certainly do that. I will note that notably absent from all the labs that you've given us is cocci antibodies, though I'm not going to read too much into that. And then, you know, among non-infectious diseases, I think about malignant diseases that could metastasize to the nervous system, though the number of malignancies that I would think about as causing a miliary pattern is small, and I don't usually associate those with nervous system metastases. So thinking specifically about things like thyroid carcinoma. The number of lesions in the miliary pattern makes me feel less compelled to think about an invasive mold infection, especially in a patient who's not neutropenic, whose diabetes is not perfectly controlled, but certainly not at the level where I would worry too much about significant phagocyte dysfunction. And so I am kind of leaning toward this being a granulomatous infection with simultaneous involvement of the lungs and the brain parenchyma specifically, with this interesting kind of rheumatologic manifestation of the sclera.
And Varun, I loved your thoughts. And here the host, thinking about the host, like with an A1C of close to 9 and maybe untreated rheumatoid arthritis, do you think this patient like needs to be more immunocompromised to get this like very disseminated infection? Or do you think like diabetes is enough as a risk factor? Because there could always be a condition that can cause the patient to be immunodeficient. We just haven't found it yet. Or in your mind, is this sufficient for this seeming infection?
Yeah, that's a great question, Youssef. And this is a common dilemma in ID in that we don't have a good measurement of immune dysfunction in patients who don't have, you know, a disease that we have like an easy metric for. So, for example, HIV, we have the CD4 count, or patients who have recently had a bone marrow transplant, we think about their ANC. This patient has some degree of neutrophil dysfunction from chronic hyperglycemia, but I don't usually associate that level of hyperglycemia with enough neutrophil dysfunction to think about like invasive aspergillosis or mucormycosis or fusariosis. I usually am, I think, invoking those diseases in people who are not only functionally neutropenic, but absolutely neutropenic for a really long period of time. The untreated rheumatoid arthritis certainly means that her cell-mediated immunity is not normal. I don't necessarily have to think about a very T-cell depleted individual to think about disseminated TB and disseminated cocci in particular, because those organisms have this propensity to disseminate beyond the pulmonary system. There are certainly risk factors for disseminated coccidiomycosis, older age being one of them that this patient has, and others that, you know, haven't been mentioned so far. And then TB can cause extrapulmonary disease even in ostensibly immunocompetent individuals. So I don't, for some pathogens, I don't anchor so much on what their immunodeficiency is, but for others, I would. So for example, I would not expect disseminated histoplasmosis in someone without a more overt T-cell defect.
Yeah, yeah. Like John Green said, everything's tuberculosis. So I agree, like it is still on the differential. I also like think cocci is with the exposure history is very high on the differential as well. Sometimes I also wonder about autoantibodies that cause immune deficiency that we may not know about or we may not have uncovered in this case, like anti-GM-CSF antibodies. Mark presented a case to us, on a schema episode where the patient, we didn't know it initially on presentation, but then after uncovering a invasive infection that was discovered. So that's always worries me as well. So if I had to put my nickel down, I would also say cocci. And that's not just because everyone suggested it. back to you, Tara. I can't wait to hear more.
Awesome. Amazing discussion. So let me give you a little bit more information and reveal the diagnosis. So We did get a serum COX-E antibody, which was negative. At our institution, we have a serum mold PCR, which looks at Aspergillus species, Mucorales, Scytosporium, and Fusarium, which was negative. We also sent a dimorphic PCR, which looks at COX-E, histoplasmosis, and blastomycosis in the serum, which was negative. We followed up those cultures that the ophthalmology team took from the left eye. Bacterial culture was negative. Fungal culture was negative. But the AFB culture did grow 50 to 100 colonies of Mycobacterium bovis. And shortly after, our sputum cultures ended up also growing Mycobacterium bovis. So the final diagnosis was disseminated Mycobacterium bovis, disseminating to the eye, causing nodular scleritis, miliary pattern in the lungs, and multiple subcentimeter nodules in the brain.
Wow, what a fascinating case. I should rephrase that to everything is microbacteria. But wow, that's a really fascinating case. I think of M. bovis, like that could be acquired from drinking like unpasteurized milk. So it's really common and can disseminate. Varun, what are your reflections?
Well, everything is MTB complex. this is amazing diagnosis, Uttara, and it's amazing that the organism was recovered from so many different sites. Tells you the burden of disease. I similarly usually associate invasive infections due to this organism either with like an immunocompromised patient who's had BCG instillation therapy for bladder cancer, or primary immunodeficiencies in young infants who received the BCG vaccine, or patients who've had an epidemiologic exposure like the ones Youssef has described, like unpasteurized milk or other dairy product exposure. So I'd be curious to know if you elicited that additional information from the patient in retrospect. What a fascinating case.
Yeah, you guys absolutely nailed it. And yes, when we talked to her again, it turns out her family in Mexico lives on a dairy farm. And so she works very closely with cows and often drinks unpasteurized milk straight from the cow. So we do think that was ultimately, you know, the exposure that she had. And, you know, it was really, really interesting because we had a lot of back and forth during this case with the rheumatology team, because, you know, like Youssef brought up in the beginning, we had really no data to support TB. We had like a big hunch that it was something in the MTB complex, but her AFB smears were negative, her MTB PCRs were negative. She had a negative quant, which again doesn't diagnose TB, but you know, helps us risk stratify for latent TB. So it was a big multidisciplinary discussion about, you know, is this actually uncontrolled rheumatoid arthritis that's causing these eye symptoms? And is the, you know, are the brain and the lung lesions, you know, it's kind of a separate entity. So it was really cool to kind of get this unifying diagnosis and actually get culture data from the eye to kind of cinch the diagnosis.
Yeah, completely fascinating. And Uttara, how did the patient do? And is there any like teaching points you wanted to share with us?
Yeah, she is doing pretty well. She did end up being hospitalized a couple more times because of some complications with her medications, including cytopenias. One thing to know about Mycobacterium bovis is that it's intrinsically resistant to pyrazinamide. So the way that we treat M. bovis is really similar to how we treat tuberculosis in that, you know, multi-drug regimen, but we don't use pyrazinamide. And there's different kind of medications you can substitute for pyrazinamide. And in her case, we used linezolid. So she did develop some cytopenias to that. And so we had to kind of work through that. But clinically, she's doing so much better. Her eye symptoms have actually completely resolved. And she's now kind of regained her strength and she's able to walk two blocks again. So it's been really cool to kind of continue to follow her in clinic and see, you know, her kind of get back to baseline.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. Hope you all have a good day.
Thanks, Uttara. That case was amazing, and kudos to you for being persistent about making the diagnosis and then sticking with it as she takes these medicines for such a long time. I'm glad she's doing so much better.
That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.